Thank you, Zmira, and it's good to see so many people who are so interested in Sefer Nehemiah. Although it is a fascinating Sefer, but that's not going to be our topic for today. Today we're going to talk about Sefirat HaOmer, and particularly the laws of mourning. And analytically, therefore, I think it's helpful to start off with the idea that the mitzvah of Sefirat HaOmer and the mitzvah of mourning during this period are two separate things that to some degree are not even connected, although I'll try to show you that in fact they are connected on a deeper level. The mitzvah of counting the days between Pesach and Shavuos is in the Torah itself, and in fact it is in this coming week's Parsha, Parshas Emor, Usvartem lachem mimacharas haShabbos, you shall start counting from the day after Shabbos. Now, this is itself a controversy, but we interpret Shabbos to mean Pesach, which is a holiday. Mimacharat HaShabbos is the day after Pesach, i.e. the second day of Pesach. From the day that you bring the Omer barley offering, Sheva Shabbosos Tamimos Tiyena, you shall count 7 complete weeks, and then you celebrate the holiday of Shavuos. This is the mitzvah of counting the Omer, Sefirat HaOmer. A few points. This is not a share about Sefirat HaOmer, but I just want to make a few introductory points. Point number one is there's a big, big machlokes among the Rishonim if the counting of the Omer today is a Torah commandment or only a rabbinic commandment. The Rambam indeed says that counting the Omer even today is a da'oraisa, but most Rishonim say that since the Torah uses the Lashon, you start counting the period from the day that you bring the barley offering in the temple. The implication is when there is no temple and there is no barley offering, the counting of the Omer is only rabbinic as a zecher lamikdash, to remember what was done when there was a Beis HaMikdash. Now, normally, whether something is rabbinic or Torah makes no difference, really. You still have to do it. But there actually is a difference that's relevant for many synagogues, particularly in the United States, and that is, how early are you permitted to count the Omer? We know that from sunset, which is Shkia, until the stars coming out, is called Bein HaShmashot. It is called twilight. Halachically, the twilight period is a safek if it belongs to the night, which is the next day, or it belongs to the day, and you haven't yet changed it. That's why Shabbat can begin no later than sunset, because maybe it's night, but you can't end it until the stars come out, because maybe Bein HaShmashot is day. That's why Shabbat is not 24 hours, but de facto Shabbat is closer to 25 hours or 24 and a half hours or whatever it would be. Now, here is the issue. Can you count the Sefirat HaOmer of the new day coming when it's Bein HaShmashot? So this actually depends on whether Sefirat HaOmer is d'oraisa or Sefirat HaOmer is midrabanan. Because if Sefirat HaOmer is d'oraisa, all cases of doubt pertaining to Torah laws, you have to be strict. And therefore, I have to assume it's still daytime and I cannot count until Tzeit HaKochavim. If, on the other hand, the counting of the Omer is rabbinic, you are allowed to give yourself the benefit of the doubt and count early. The reason now, in Eretz Yisrael, it tends not to be much of a problem because twilight here is very short. As you get closer to the equator, it gets dark very quickly after sunset. But in Chutz La'aretz, more northern countries, where there might be a twilight could be very long, so one needs to know how early you can count the Omer. Okay, so that's point number one, machlokes, is it d'oraisa or d'rabanan? We should try to be machmir and treat it like d'oraisa. Point number two is technically women are exempt from the mitzvah of counting the Omer because it is a time-bound commandment that only applies 49 days a year. And positive commandments that are time-bound, although there are many exceptions, women are exempt from. However, if they want to be machmirot on themselves, then there is a mitzvah for them as well. And if you're Ashkenazi, you can even make the bracha. If you're Sephardi, you don't make the bracha, or you hear it from a man, but you can still count and get the reward. Okay, so that's the second point. Now, the third point about counting the Omer is, what's the point of it? So the Sefer HaChinuch gives us a very important philosophy, and that is, the counting of the Omer is to link, it is to connect the holiday of Pesach with the holiday of Shavuos. Pesach is Zaman Cherusenu. Pesach is the season of freedom. Shavuos is the season of Zaman Matan Torasenu. But by linking them into one holiday, it reminds us of a very important lesson, that freedom is valuable only when it is coupled with submission to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Freedom is not an end. You cannot say, the purpose of my life is to be free. Freedom enables a person to accomplish whatever goals they have. But freedom alone is not a goal. Eric Fromm, who happened to be Jewish, although not religious, Talmud of Freud, who was also Jewish, made the famous remark, the well-known remark, that we make a very big mistake when we describe freedom as freedom from something, because that's just a negative. Freedom has to be freedom towards something, freedom towards a goal. The counting of the Omer reminds us that true freedom is submission to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, the Ramban actually says that the period of Svirat HaOmer can be regarded as a huge chol hamoed. It's as if to say, Pesach is the first holiday, Shavuot are the last days, and the counting of the Omer is one long chol hamoed, because in fact it's one holiday. Now you got to be careful. If you tell your boss, for example, that you don't come into work on chol hamoed and you don't show up for 7 weeks, you might get in a little trouble. But nevertheless, the Ramban does say that Sefirat HaOmer is indeed a chol hamoed period. If I could quote a non-Jewish source, the Indian poet Tagore, who had won the Nobel Prize for Literature back in the 1920s, who I don't know if he ever knew a Jew, and he was not writing about Jews, but he once described a human soul as a violin string. A violin string can produce beautiful, moving, evocative music. But paradoxically, only when the string is tied down to the instrument. If you take a loose string, put a loose string on your kitchen table and hit it with your finger, you will get no sound from it. That's the paradox. We think total freedom will give me the ability to express all that is within me. He says no. Only when you're tied down and you're disciplined and you're connected to something higher than yourself will you then be able to have the freedom to produce the beautiful music that you're able to produce. And Chazal made the point that that is why the grain offering on Pesach is barley, which was commonly fed to animals. This is before cholent was invented. And on Shavuot, the grain offering is wheat, which is human consumption, because the idea is freedom without Torah is animal freedom. And with Torah, it now becomes human dignity. In fact, the Ishbitzer says, the great Hasidic Rebbe says, that this is why many of us had a minug at the Seder to have a hard-boiled egg. And there are a lot of reasons, but he gave a very interesting reason, that a bird is born in two stages. There is the laying of an egg, and then the hatching of an egg, unlike a mammal that is born live. And the concept is, this reminds us on Pesach night, that we are born in two stages. Yetziat Mitzrayim is the laying of the egg, but our full birth does not occur until Shavuos. So when we look at the egg, we think of how Am Yisrael came into being. Okay, so this is counting of the Omer. Now, there is nothing intrinsic to the counting of the Omer that ought to be a sad occasion. The Torah does not talk about sadness here. Lehepech, exactly the opposite. If we're asking ourselves, what is the intended mood that the Torah wants us to have as we're looking forward to Mount Sinai, to Kabbalah Satorah? The mood should be one of joyous anticipation. Okay, it's very important to understand this. It is not inherent in the Omer period that it be a period of sadness. And the other way around, even with the mourning, there should be an element of joy that is accompanied to getting ready for the Torah. So the question becomes, so where did we introduce this idea of sadness, of mourning, of restrictions? It has nothing to do with the counting of the Omer, and it has nothing to do with the meaning of the counting of the Omer. So the answer is, this comes from a much later period, and in fact, mourning rituals are not mentioned in the Mishnah or the Gemara, either the Babylonian Talmud or the Jerusalem Talmud. The very first mention we have of minhagei avelut, a minhagim of mourning, is in the writings of the Gaonim of Bavel. The Gaonim of Bavel were the great rabbis and leaders after the Talmud was finished. So we're talking about the 8th century, the 9th century, the 10th century. So it's been a while. It's been around a long time. And they say, even they don't really say it's a halacha. They say there are places. So it's interesting. Who was the inventor of this? It's hard to know. It says there are places in which marriages don't take place during this period of the Omer. So you always wonder, when the Gaonim themselves say there are places, somebody must have thought of this. You may hate the person or not, but whatever it is, we don't know exactly who is the inventor of this. But it is already recorded in the Gaonim, and later codified in the Shulchan Aruch and the like. And the reason that's given is that during this period of time, a very sad event is commemorated. Now, don't be confused here. The sad event is recorded in the Gemara. When I say the mourning is not in the Gemara, I meant the Gemara does not say we have to observe avelut. But the event is recorded in the Gemara, and this is the tragic story of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. Now, this itself is quite an amazing story, because as you know, Rabbi Akiva was an Am Haaretz. He was ignorant, and he was a shepherd to the wealthiest landowner in Yerushalayim, Kalba Savua, and Kalba Savua's daughter, Rachel, fell in love with this ignorant shepherd because she saw in him a greatness that he himself did not realize that he had. And she married him over the objections of her father, and her father even made a vow that he disinherited her, that none of his property could go to her. So she lived in poverty with her husband, and at some point she sent her husband, who was more than 40 years old, to go to Yerushalayim to learn Torah. And he started with the first graders, and he was there for 12 years. And after 12 years, he came back home to pay a visit, and he overheard his wife talking to a neighbor, and the neighbor said, "What type of husband do you have that leaves you for 12 years? And she said, "I wouldn't mind if he'd go for another 12 years. And the story that is recorded is he went for another 12 years. Now again, one should not, and certainly neither you nor your husband should take any practical suck from this, but this was the level that they were at. And after 24 years, he was no longer that ignorant shepherd. He was the greatest of the rabbis of Israel. He was the great Rabbi Akiva, and he came back with 24,000 students. Can you imagine all the years that his wife suffered, that they both suffered, but particularly his wife suffered, all those years of deprivation?
she now sees what she created together with him and how much joy it would give to her heart. And she's ragged, and she goes to approach Rabbi Akiva, and the students think she's some crazy woman. They push her away, and Rabbi Akiva utters the famous words, Shali v'shalachem, all that I am and all that you are, Shalah is only because of her. In the meantime, Kalba Savua, who had disinherited his daughter, he had plenty of money. She didn't have to live in poverty. Kalba Savua all of a sudden has regrets over the difficult situation he put his daughter in, and he wanted to matir neder. He wanted to get annulment for his vow. And you need a great rabbi to annul a vow. So he heard this great rabbi is showing up in town. He didn't know this was his son-in-law. So he goes to the son-in-law. Rabbi Akiva recognized him. And he says, you know, many years ago, I made a vow hurting my daughter. And I regret making that vow. And in order to regret a vow, you have to say, had you known something, you wouldn't have made it. So Rabbi Akiva said, if you would have known that your son-in-law would have become a Torah scholar, would you have made the vow? So he said, Torah scholar, if I would have known he would know how to read Hebrew, I wouldn't have made the vow. So Rabbi Akiva said, the vow is annulled. So these are the 24,000 students, and they are the ones that shortly after died in a plague between Pesach and Shavuos. Now, obviously, 24,000 student people dying is a great tragedy, of course. And the fact that they're Torah scholars makes it even greater. But I can't help thinking, on one level, although maybe this is not the major tragedy, but of the personal element of tragedy that this adds to the life of Rachel. You're waiting. And you finally see the bracha of all of your efforts. And then it all gets taken away. It all collapses. So the Gaonim say that the minhag of mourning during the Omer is to mourn the deaths of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. Now, let's ask a very simple question here. Wait a second here. Okay, 24,000 students, again, that's a tragedy, of course. But to be frank, we've had worse. I mean, we have Holocaust, we had Crusades, we had many situations. I mean, we don't have mourning, we don't have a mourning period for the Shoah. I mean, we have Yom HaShoah, whatever, but we don't have a period where you're not allowed to get married. So what is it about the students of Rabbi Akiva that we memorialize them every single year for such a long period of time? And I'll talk in a moment about how long the period, that's going to be complicated. So the answer is this. The answer is, if the problem would simply be mourning a tragic event, you'd have a very good kasha. I mean, this was a tragic event, but we have other tragic events. And indeed, the hashkafa often is, we fold them into Tisha B'Av. Right? In fact, somebody once asked the Brisker Rav, why don't the from world have a fast day to remember the Holocaust? Why don't we have a, not just Yom HaShoah, why don't we have a fast? Why don't we have a fast day, Lezecher, the Kedoshim who died in the Shoah? And the Brisker Rav answered that Tisha B'Av is our fast day for all of the suffering of the Jewish people. So let that include Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim. Why do you have a special period? So the explanation is, the mourning of Sfira is not simply mourning, but it's trying to rectify. Because most of the time, we don't know the reason for tragedies. We don't know why there was a Holocaust. People say this, people say that. I know Rabbi Victor Miller wrote a book. But all of that is speculation. We're not Nevi'im, and we don't know reasons for things. But for the deaths of the students of Rabbi Akiva, we happen to be given a reason by Chazal. Okay, that's unique. The Shoah, the Crusades, the pogroms, any reason we give is just guessing. Even if great rabbis say it, but they're guessing fundamentally. The deaths of Rabbi Akiva, we have a reason. And the reason is, and this is in the Gemara, Lai Nahagu Kavait Zelaze. They did not show proper honor to each other. Now, this is hard to understand. We read in yesterday's Parsha the verse, V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your friend as you love yourself. And Rabbi Akiva himself taught that that is a klal gadol, that is the most fundamental principle of the Torah. One would assume that Rabbi Akiva's students were suffused with the teaching of their Rebbe, how important it is to love and respect your fellow Jew, even your fellow human being, and not even a Jew necessarily. How could Bedavka Rabbi Akiva's students fail in that particular department that was such a fundamental teaching of their great teacher? However you understand it, it has to be lefi madregasam. By that I mean, we don't mean they pushed each other, they insulted each other. We don't mean, they abused each other. I imagine if we would see Rabbi Akiva's students behaving, they would look like polite B'nai Torah. But in their heart, they didn't truly have respect. Rav Hirsch makes a very beautiful observation. Kavod, honor, is the same shorish as kaved, which is heaviness. To honor somebody doesn't just mean I'm polite. I could be polite to somebody, but I don't really consider them significant. In English, we talk about, sometimes we say somebody is a heavyweight. We don't mean they're a boxer necessarily, or even that they're fat. But when somebody is like a very significant person, an intellectual, a brilliant person, a scientist, we say he's a heavyweight in his field. Kavod, Rav Hirsch says, is I look at a person and I see their significance. I see them as choshev. I see them as weighty. And on that, the students of Rabbi Akiva were a little deficient. So here is the point. The reason why we single out the deaths of Rabbi Akiva's students more than other tragedies is because we are now given a specific assignment that we can work upon. Meaning like this, if I were to say, let's not make weddings for 3 weeks because of the Shoah, so then the question would be, well, what lesson am I supposed to learn from that? So again, people will come up with lessons, this lesson, that lesson, but it's only speculation. But since we know specifically why the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died, that tells me that what is my avoda during the period of the Omer? To learn to see the kavod in another Jew, to learn to love that other Jew. And that is why it is no accident that it happened during this period of time, because this period of time is to prepare us for receiving the Torah. But in order to receive the Torah, we have to be ish echad uvelev echad, one person, one heart. If the greatest rabbis of the generation to come do not have that midah, then God says they cannot be the leaders. They will be taken away. And that's our avoda during Sfiras HaOmer, part and parcel of how we prepare for Kabbalat HaTorah is by working and growing in Avat Yisrael and in not just loving people. In fact, this is the one kash I have in Rav Kook. There's a famous vort from Rav Kook. I mean, who am I to make any argument than Rav Kook? I mean, much less than dirt. Rav Kook is a famous vort that people like to say that if the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of sinat chinam, hatred for no reason, it will only be rebuilt when we have avat chinam, love for no reason. Meaning, don't make cheshbonos, you love your fellow Jew. But my little ha'ara is, it's a little ha'ara, that love for no reason may not necessarily be the right attitude. Because love for no reason actually implies that that person is undeserving of love, but I'll love him anyway. That's not the avoda. The avoda of kavod is to see the value in the other person. Not say, you're worthless, but I love you anyway. But rather, to see the kavod. This is Rav Hirsch's point. Kavod. Weighty. Heavy. Significant. Right? This is our avoda during Sfiras HaOmer. For no reason. That's right. No, yeah, that's a good point. Meaning, if you can come up with reasons for hate, you can come up with reasons for love. That's right. Right. Somehow it's easier for us to come up with the other reason, right? You're right. Okay. So now, let me move into something. The mitzvah of counting the Omer is 49 days. No question about that. But how long is the period of mourning over the Omer? Well, before I get to that, let's get to the activities. What activities are prohibited during the mourning period? Then we'll get into what the mourning period is. So, in truth, the Shulchan Aruch only says two things are prohibited. Getting married and getting haircuts. Haircuts, cutting hair. That is, those are the two activities that are forbidden. Now, and haircuts, cutting hair. Now, the question that everybody always asks is, where does it say you cannot listen to music during the Omer? So, numerous rabbis over the years, at least if they're inexperienced, say, well, everybody knows you don't listen to music on the Omer. It must be in the Mishnah Berurah. And they take out a Mishnah Berurah, and they turn the page, this page, that page, that page, that page, that page. I will tell you, you won't find it. There is no reference. Again, don't turn off until I finish the thought. There is no reference in the Shulchan Aruch that music is prohibited during the Omer. Again, let me emphasize, the only two activities that are prohibited during the Omer under the halacha, which itself is a minhag, but it became a halacha, is weddings, nisuin, and taspores, cutting hair. Again, I'll get to the time periods in a moment. So where does listening to music come from? Why is it such a minhag not listening to music? So Rav Moshe Feinstein actually writes that the problem is this. There is a view in the Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to listen to music the whole year because it's a zecher l'chorban, and therefore the Shulchan Aruch had no reason to mention Omer or the 3 weeks for that matter because it's usher the whole year unless it's a mitzvah like a chasna that you're allowed to make. So Rav Moshe says, even though we don't follow the Shulchan Aruch strict view the whole year, but for certain periods of sadness, we don't listen to music. In other words, it's not because of a special sphera rule. It's taking a chumrah that in theory would be appropriate the whole year, but you apply it for the sphera period. Which means, in other words, if some wise guy wants to say, I just want to follow the Shulchan Aruch, don't give me any chumras. Shulchan Aruch says, no marriage, no haircuts, that's what I'm going to do. Well, I'll tell the guy, okay, you want to follow the Shulchan Aruch, you cannot listen to music the whole year. Okay, you're better off with the sphera restrictions than you would be. Now, there are many, I'm not going to give you an individual psak here because it all depends on a lot of things. Some say it only applies to live music and they will permit recorded music. Even those who are strict on recorded music may permit a cappella music. Those are the infamous or the famous Sfira tapes. It's not so pashut, but you know, but many, many allow that. If somebody is depressed or agitated or anxious, then I don't think they need to be machmer on music, but preferably it should be headphones, and it should not be like dancing, bouncy music. It should be more, you know, slow music or the like. Meaning there is a lot of flexibility in the music area. If you are a professional musician, you are allowed to practice during Sfira to be able to play the jobs that you're allowed to play, assuming you're allowed to play. And of course, a musician is allowed to play, let's say for Goyim, whatever it is, even during Sfira. So music is an issue that you need to talk about. And by the way, you have very similar issues regarding even a longer period of not listening to music, and that's when, God forbid, somebody is an avelus for a father and a mother, and technically they don't listen to music for 12 months. That can be extraordinarily difficult, and one should know that there is a lot of leeway if one is listening to more quiet music by headphones and it's not live. I'm not giving an indiscriminate heter for it, but individual cases, there is a great makom to be makel. So once again, therefore, the core activities are marriage, haircuts, the additional activity, music, and there's another one that comes in, which is people always ask the question, can I buy new things during the Omer mourning period? So let me explain what's going on here. The problem is not buying new things. You are allowed to buy things during the Omer period. The problem is, the minog is, you don't recite a shecheyanu during the Omer period, because it's not a happy time. So consequently, any type of acquisition for which you would make a shecheyanu, you try to avoid during the Omer period. Now, what types of acquisitions do people make a shecheyanu? So that depends on the person, really. The halacha does say when you buy new clothing, you make shecheyanu. On the other hand, some do not make a shecheyanu on new clothing, because they say that the Shulchan Aruch was talking about the olden days where a person could get a new piece of clothing every 10 years, and it was a real, real exciting thing. Today, we're buying clothing for most people, most middle-class people, tends to be a bit more routine, right? So there is, again, I'm not giving you a psak, I'm just alerting you to the fact that it is not at all pashut that making a shecheyanu on clothing is appropriate, and it would depend on the person. And keep in mind as well that since our minog is we do not make shecheyanu on shoes, that's true, so there would obviously be no problem with buying shoes, no problem with buying household goods. In other words, the issue is shecheyanu, and even that, you're allowed to make shecheyanu on Shabbos. So if you buy something you'd be worn on Shabbos, there is no problem. So the kiniyot, the issue of buying, is not... so you save it for Shabbos. If you get a new fruit, don't eat new fruits during the week, but save it for Shabbos, and then you make a shecheyanu on Shabbos itself. Okay, so these are the things, right? So there is marriage, there is haircuts, there is music, and there is kiniyot, which involve the recitation of a birkat shecheyanu. Now, with haircuts too, let me point out, again, I'll get to the time frame, that's obviously very important. Yeah. Getting into water. No, I believe that is a confusion with the 3 weeks. The 3 weeks, such a minig is brought down. I don't think it applies to Sfira at all. That's another thing people are often confused, because these are both mourning periods, but their halachos are not going to be the same. With haircuts and shaving, this includes shaving for men. So first of all, for a woman to shave her legs or something like that is mutter, bichlal, that's mutter, because that's a question of looking in a good way. For a man to shave, well, it's better to be machmir, but some say if the man has a job, I guess maybe less so in Eretz Yisrael, where he's expected to be clean-shaven every day. There are heterim there too. Again, I don't want to give individual psukim. It depends on the situation. Now, yeshiva boys often ask, and I have to admit I don't hear this shaila, but they often ask, am I allowed to get a haircut or shave if I'm going out on a date for shiduchim? Now, strangely enough, there are heterim for it. But I don't get it. If I would be a girl who wants to marry a frum guy, and I see the guy shaves during Sfira,
To me, that should be a negative, not a positive. So I don't get it. What's the heter that for a firm girl I got to shave and get a haircut to go out on a date? But nevertheless, I will tell you that there are rabbanim who say that there's a mitzvah to make yourself presentable, and they allow it. Yeah. Say again? Oh, okay. She should down on the kafzuchus that he asked the shayla, right? But then the girl can say, what type of girl do you think I am? You ask a shayla. You know, like, he must have asked the shayla, oh, this girl will not want to go out with me if I have a sphera beard or whatever. Okay. All righty. So now, the big question is that although the counting of the Omer is 49 days, the avelut of the Omer is only part of that time. Okay? And I want to explain four different minhagim and where they come from. Minhag number one is the minhag of Svardim, and this is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. And interestingly enough, minhag number one says the students of Rabbi Akiva died for 33 days and then they stopped. Meaning to say, they died for 33 days, including Lag BaOmer. They died from the second day of Pesach to Lag BaOmer, and therefore the Svira restrictions are lifted on Lad BaOmer, 34th day. Meaning, it's fascinating. Although Sfardim make a very big deal in Meiron, and we hope, Ezras Hashem, that this year should be much, much safer, Be'ezrat Hashem, but Sfardim make a very big deal, but in terms of Avelut, Sfardim, they still cannot make weddings on Lag BaOmer, meaning to say, Svira restrictions come off on the 34th day of the Omer, and not on the 33rd day of the Omer. The Ramah brings, for Ashkenazim, that we stop our Avelut on Lag BaOmer. And even though we might agree that people still died on Lag BaOmer, but the concept is on the last day of Avelut, like the last day of Shiva, we always say Miktzat Hayom. You only have to keep part of the day, etc. So, Minhag 1 is full Avelut through Lag BaOmer. Minhag number 2 is full Avelut up to Lag BaOmer, but from Lag BaOmer onwards, everything is mutar. Now, within that minhag, there are two variations. Is that only the day of Lag BaOmer or even the night of Lag BaOmer? Are you allowed to make a wedding the night of Lag BaOmer? Or do you have to wait until the day? Because Miktzat Hayom Kekulo by Shiva is you have to carry it over to the beginning of the next day. That's a machlokas. Again, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Okay. Minhag number 3 is that you start your Avelut, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, started today, and you go for 33 days, which takes you until 3 days before Shavuot. So that's, those are called Shlosh Shemei Hagbala. Shavuot is the 6th of Sivan. 3, 4, 5 are the Shlosh Shemei Hagbala. So according to this minhag, you start your Avelut today, you go until, and not including the third day of Sivan, but Lag BaOmer is a break in the Avelut. Okay? In other words, until Rosh Chodesh, like this last week, you could have had weddings, everything else, etc. Rosh Chodesh, you start the Isser, you go until the third of Sivan, 3 days before Matan Torah, with Lag BaOmer a hiatus. The fourth minhag is you start after Rosh Chodesh. So that would mean that you start Tuesday, right? Tuesday or Monday night. And you go till Erev Shavuot. You go because you have to make up 2 days. You go until the 5th of Sivan with Lag BaOmer as a hiatus. How many minhagim have we mentioned? I'm losing count. Four, okay. The fifth minhag is you simply go, there is such a minhag, you simply go 49 days, you simply keep the Avelut restrictions throughout with Lag BaOmer as hiatus. So every view does have Lag BaOmer as a permissible day, except
the Svardic view of Rav Yosef Karo, who considers Lag BaOmer to still be a day of Avelus. Yeah. Oh, okay, okay. So here's the thing. All right, so this is very, very clear. Once, if a wedding occurred when it was allowed to take place, either before Rosh Chodesh or on Rosh Chodesh, it occurred, or Lag BaOmer for that matter, if the wedding was a permissible wedding, then even though the Sheva Brachos, the week, will obviously intrude into the Sfira, you are allowed to have regular Sheva Brachos. In fact, many will allow even music during the Sheva Brachos. Yeah, because it's a continuation of a permissible wedding. Yes, yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah, yeah. A very, very, very excellent question. These are the two problems. You know, the state of Israel, we have two commemorate. Well, we have more than that, but in Nisan and Iyar, we have two commemorative days. We had Yom HaShoah a few days ago, and we have Yom HaTzmaut this week. So the problem is, both of them are halachically problematical. Yom HaShoah in the month of Nisan, you're not supposed to make sad days in the month of Nisan. And Yom HaTzmaut, the 5th of Iyar, is during Sviras HaOmer, after Rosh Chodesh. It's in the period of mourning that is Usher L'Chulei Alma. Now, all I can tell you is this. I'm not going to give my personal opinions. That's not relevant. The Rabbanut HaRashit, the Rabbanut has paskind that the joy of Yom HaTzmaut does permit music during Sfira, especially since, as I said at the outset, music during Sfira is not such a clear-cut isser. Anyway, so the Rabbanut has given a psak for many years, since 1948. They have given a psak that music is permitted. Many disagree with that psak, even if they hold of Yom HaTzmaut as a festive day. So once again, I have to tell you to ask your local rabbi. Meaning Yom HaTzmaut is a matter of controversy on many, many, many levels. But one of the controversies, which is maybe the smaller controversy, is the issue of live music during the counting of the Omer. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so you'd have the same problem. Meaning, this problem would be the same. Meaning to say, the ideological issue is less pronounced for Yom Yerushalayim. In fact, there are those, like Rav Schechter, for example, who does not say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut, but believes that Hallel is properly recited on Yom Yerushalayim. But as far as I know, this would not give you a heter for the music, so that issue is still going to remain. Again, I forgive me for evading giving you definitive answers on things, but you know, I just want to leave here in one piece. So I will try not to be too controversial. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's obviously an interesting correlation that you have these two groups of 24 that are here, but I am not aware of it, but I'll try to look into it. There must be a correlation for sure in many, many ways. And it is also brought down, just to give you another, now this is brought down in the Zohar, that somehow the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva were a reincarnation of the 24,000 Jews who died in the plague of the fornication with the Moabites in Baal Peor. And somehow they were supposed to be mitaken, and they were not mitaken, so they were taken away again. Now, let me just allude. I just have two very quick issues I need to bring out, and then I'll stop at a very, very important issue. And that is, Rav Moshe Feinstein has an enormously important psak. And he says, let's say your minog is you start from the second day of Pesach, and you go to Lag BaOmer. And you're invited to a wedding that somebody is making right after Pesach. And you're going to a wedding that is during your Svirat HaOmer period. Are you, or let's say you're invited to a wedding after Lag BaOmer. You start Rosh Chodesh, you go through Shlosh Yemei Hagbalah. So are you allowed to go to that wedding? So this is what Rav Moshe says. Rav Moshe says, a big chiddush, although it makes a lot of sense. A person is allowed to go to a wedding during his Sfira period. Because the only thing that's forbidden during Sfira is getting married. There is There is no prohibition to go to the wedding of somebody else who's getting married. Therefore, Rav Moshe says, you, this is a very important psak, you are allowed to go to a wedding as long as the chatan and the kala are making the wedding when it's mutter. Now, you wouldn't be allowed to go to a wedding, you know, by non from people who are making it in the middle of Iyar, because that's a prohibited period. But as long as the wedding is permitted for them, you're allowed to go. Now, Rav Moshe says, not only are you allowed to go, but you're even allowed to listen to music, obviously, because you're going. And Rav Moshe even says, if the person is unkempt, and they would be embarrassed to show up at a wedding with, you know, not trimmed hair, whatever it is, they could even get a haircut. A man could shave in order to go to the wedding. So this is a very, very important psak, because it comes up a lot that you'll be invited to chasanas that are during your mourning period, and people ask the wrong question. People often ask, oh, can I switch my minhagim? Okay, we don't have time to get into that, but the point I want to make is, according to Rav Moshe, you don't have to switch your minhagim. Even your own minhag, people are asking the wrong question, even your own minhag will allow you to go. Okay, so I think for that, since the reason why people want to switch minhagim is almost 100% because of this reason, once you have this reason, you don't have to consider the more complicated issue. Can I switch from one to another? That's a little more complicated, because every minhag that I have becomes like a vow, and I may have to have ataras nadarim. But with this psak, you don't need to get into that whole issue. So be it as it may, I just want to point out that the idea of Lag BaOmer as either the end of the deaths or the hiatus in the middle is very, very instructive. And this is maybe part of a longer shir, but I'll say it very quickly. Every week of the Omer is connected to a personality. Week one is Avraham's week. Week two is Yitzchak. The Omer, Lag BaOmer, is in the sixth week of the Omer. The sixth week of the Omer. It is the week of Aaron HaKohen. Now, not only that, but it is also the day of Aaron, because it is the fifth day of the fifth week. It is the day of Aaron in the week of Aaron. Aaron represents the idea of Ohev Shalom for Rodev Shalom. When Aaron's spiritual power comes into the world, it brings in its wake Achdus and unity and love and Shalom. The message of the students of Rabbi Akiva stopping dying on Lag BaOmer is that the stronger the Midah of Aaron, the less the Magefa will have its power. And that's why Lag BaOmer was that double dose of Aaron was the basis for the cessation of the Magefa. So I wish you all a Chodesh Tov, and may all of us merit the Gula Shleimah.